Hello everyone, and welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Dmitry Atapin, and I'll be your guide through the first Carte Blanche concert of Music at Menlo's 2025 season, Constellations Ensemble Magic. This unique program comes to us from a collaboration between two extraordinary artists, violinist Kristen Lee and pianist Michael Steven Brown. Together, they offer a vibrant celebration of American music, its heritage, its cultural diversity, and its spirit of innovation. We asked Kristen and Michael what inspired them to curate this particular program. Here is Kristen Lee sharing her perspective.
So this program featuring all of these American composers was really an idea that I proposed to Michael. Part of the reason was because I was working on like an American program project along with a recording that I had also put out earlier. So I was just doing a lot of research in discovering and learning more about what American music means and what American music is out there. What are the pieces and who are the composers that we celebrate, but who are also the composers and the pieces that we don't really know about? I think the American music is a bit of that hidden gem because so much is unknown to the majority, and a lot of different kind of compositional tools and different kinds of sounds and exploration of different music has really been invented through a lot of the musical history of America. So this program was really about delving into that idea and being able to showcase and share and educate our audience about more American music.
The program features music by Fritz Kreisler, Charles Ives, Ernest Bloch, John Adams, Amy Beach, George Gershwin, and even a charming composition by Michael Steven Brown. We wanted to learn more about how these specific works and composers came together in this imaginative lineup. Here is Michael Steven Brown with his insights.
The pieces really do relate to each other. Chronologically, we have a lot of early 20th century works like the Bloch Second Sonata and the Ives Fourth Sonata and Amy Beach, although she's a little earlier, but you can really get a sense of how American composers were writing in such vastly different styles around the same time. And that's really cool to see, like, what is America? What is the musical life going on? And all these composers bring their own influences and pave their own way, but all are doing it geographically not that far from each other.
The concert opens with Fritz Kreisler's Preludium and Allegro. Wildly hailed as one of the greatest violinists of the early 20th century, Kreisler was born in 1875 in Vienna and became the youngest student ever admitted to the Vienna Conservatory at the age of 7. By 14, he was already touring Europe and had made a celebrated debut in the United States. Yet, in a surprising turn, he stepped away from music to study medicine and art. After an 8-year hiatus, Kreisler returned to the violin in 1899 and quickly rose to international fame. Renowned for his uniquely warm tone, expressive phrasing, and charismatic presence, marked by unmatched elegance and refined taste. When he moved permanently to the United States in 1914, his performances caused a sensation. Fans lined up by the thousands outside the world's great concert halls, eager to hear even a single note from the legendary Kreisler. Composed in 1905, Preludium and Allegro has become a cherished showpiece, beloved by both performers and listeners. Though originally presented as a romantic homage to the 18th century Italian violinist Gaetano Pugnani, Kreisler later admitted the work was entirely his own creation. Let us hear from Kristen Lee.
This is maybe one of his most well-known works, and actually, in fact, it's very well-known, especially when violinists are first learning the violin. It's a piece that is often played with the younger, or they just started learning the violin for maybe about 2-3 years. And it's considered, quote unquote, a student piece. And then when you realize these works that have sort of become known with that kind of label, and then you delve into it again later in your life and realize how incredibly beautiful these pieces are, it's like a new adventure, a new perspective that you can bring and also celebrate in a very different sort of angle. So that's why I wanted to start the program with the Preludium and Allegro. It's also a very interesting way to bookend the first half because the first three notes, or I guess the first four or five notes of the Kreisler versus the Bloch is actually exactly the same, but coming from the very opposite range of the violin, and with us also an incredibly different kind of atmosphere and character. So you're exploring the range of the violin with the same exact notes, but in a completely different way. So I thought that would be a very interesting way to also bookend the first half.
The piece unfolds in two sections, a majestic preludium with its sweeping gestures, and a dazzling allegro where virtuosic violin lines sparkle with Baroque flair. Here is Kristen Lee with a description of the preludium.
In the preludium of the Preludium and Allegro, it's a very interesting beginning because you are hearing the same notes, the E and B, over and over again. And in the score, you're just looking at basically consecutive quarter notes. So if you look at the piece of music, it could look very pedantic or very vertical, but there's so much that Kreisler allows through his harmony that you could explore very different kinds of musical ideas. And so I think that's really interesting. It could be performed in so many different ways, and I think that's very interesting too. The sort of unified look of the notes and the rhythm, plus the fact that the piano is just sort of holding these whole notes, creates a lot of opportunity for the violin to express in very different ways.
Portly, captivating music. As we transition into the Allegro, we enter a 19th century reimagining of Baroque colors, a time when reviving works by old masters, or cheekily attributing one's own works to them, was all the rage, adding a sense of gravitas and prestige. Here is Kristen Lee again.
In the Allegro of the Preludium Allegro, Kreisler delves into something that is much more virtuosic, a little bit more showcasing the sort of the faster sort of notes of what the violin can do. But he does it in a way that is almost like Bach. A lot of it is very sequenced. There are a lot of different motifs. It's also sort of like a rondo form where you're always hearing return of the same material to sort of bring in the sections. And so it's a very, very contrasting section to what the Preludium really stands for. And it's a showstopper way to begin a program.
As we can see, the program's first piece already reflects a coming to America spirit through Kreisler's own story of relocation. The second piece, however, is pure American soil, Charles Ives's Fourth Violin Sonata, often hailed as the work of an American original, and indeed, Ives himself is frequently called the first true American original in music. Born in Connecticut in 1874, Charles Ives was a pioneering figure who blended experimentation and tradition in daring ways that defied the conventions of his time. A visionary maverick, Ives wove together American folk songs, hymn tunes, and unorthodox harmonies, creating a sound world that initially puzzled early listeners, but has since come to captivate audiences worldwide. Here is pianist Michael Stephen Brown sharing his thoughts on Ives's singular artistic world.
Charles Ives, great American composer, was not really popular until much later, and now is really considered a real father figure of American music, I would say in a generation earlier than Aaron Copland, but his name really carries a huge weight, and his music is often inspired by hymns and folk music, and he also had another career in his life, so he's a very interesting figure who made money doing other things. But I think there's something I do want to share about Ives outside of the Fourth Violin Sonata, which we'll talk about in a second, is his daily schedule, which is just one of the coolest things I've ever seen in a composer's life, because I'm really fascinated with, like, how does a composer live and how do they structure their day? And Ives wrote out in 1914 in a book called Our Book, his daily schedule, which I don't know if I want to waste all your time reading, but he's detailed 6:30 up and about, 6:45 chores, which include fire and coal and pump and spring water, and 7:30 to 7:45 he plays Bach, then he has breakfast, then he does hard work, then he does farm work, then he loafs, then he lunches and reads, and more farm work, and waters trees and wood, and then he has dinner. Then he smokes and talks, then he reads at 8, and at 9 he goes to bed. And the assumption is 6:30 a.m. the next morning he gets up and does it all over again. And I find that really cool as a composer to find a routine. It's like, what times of day is he most creative? Okay, so he's writing music in the morning, he's studying Bach. That's interesting that he's infusing his first thoughts of the day with Bach's music. And then in the afternoon, he's basically doing 4 hours of yard work outdoors, which is also interesting as a composer that he's, working in the yard, chopping wood? I mean, who is this man? We look at a name on a piece of paper and we look at dots in a page, but it's so cool to, like, think about the world in which he was living in. And I actually think that's really cool in relation to this fourth sonata, which actually comes from exactly the same time as this daily schedule was made.
Ives' four violin sonatas, written between 1902 and 1916, offer an intimate window into this richly layered musical mind. The fourth violin sonata, subtitled Children's Day at the Camp Meeting, is the shortest of the set, composed between 1911 and 1916. Here is violinist Kristen Lee introducing the piece.
So Charles Ives' Violin Sonata number 4, with the subtitle Children's Day at the Camp Meeting, it's a very narrative work in that period of when Charles Ives was alive. The term camp meeting really stood for Bible camp. And Charles Ives is painting a picture through these three movements of these children at this Bible camp, basically.
This sonata draws deeply on the hymn tunes and folk melodies Ives absorbed in childhood, particularly at the outdoor revival meetings and bandstands where his father played. Blending traditional harmonies with dense clusters, layered textures, and freewheeling counterpoint, Ives sidesteps the typical virtuosity of the violin sonata form to focus instead on evoking the spirit, chaos, and innocence of a bygone American era. As Ives himself described it, the work is, quote, a kind of reflection, remembrance, expression of the children's services at the outdoor summer camp meetings held around Danbury and in many of the farm towns in Connecticut in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, end quote. the first movement was inspired by an actual event. During the outdoor services, the children, especially the boys, loved to jump up and march along to the hymn tunes, sometimes transforming the gathering into a real parade. Let's hear Kristen Lee describe the first movement.
So the first movement starts with perhaps more well-behaved and maybe just entering the camp and getting used to the camp vibe. You first hear Michael playing this rhythm that is very much representative of like a march. And then the violin enters with a very innocent and more subdued representation of this first theme. And then somehow that dives into more rowdiness. And then it abruptly ends as a very innocent tune with the end of the movement. And this is very typical of Ives. I think he loves to create a lot of illogical, something that maybe doesn't make sense to our what is expected of what we would want to hear, and then loves to create sort of sections that are much more abrupt, not expected. And then somehow it can seem chaotic, but also creates a lot of humor. So I think there's a lot of that element.
The second movement shifts to a more reflective mood, built around a gentle hymn the children cherished, Jesus Loves Me, with the accompaniment subtly evoking the outdoor sounds of nature on those long summer days.
The heart of the sonata for me is really in the second movement, titled Largo. This whole movement is themed around a very popular children's Bible camp tune called Jesus Loves Me, and it's a very, very popular tune. But Charles Ives introduces it in a way that is a little bit more fragmented, and then he always creates this sort of counter melody along with it. So it's a little bit less obvious in the beginning, and then he introduced a little fragment and then jumps into these different textural, atmospheric sort of line in the piano and the violin. And Charles Ives actually writes in his little notes, when you look at the back of the score, that he's mimicking sort of the sounds of the nature. You're hearing the birds, you're hearing the nature. And then in the middle of it, there is a preacher going into this madness. So it's a very typical thing that Ives does, where you're hearing something that is completely unexpected, and then it delves back into this beautiful thing, and then at the end, you finally hear the completion of this melody of Jesus Loves Me, and then ends with an amen.
The third movement circles back to the lively spirit of the opening. As the boys resume marching, some of the older men would join in, marching and singing their hearts out, often to the well-loved hymn, "Shall We Gather at the River?"
The third movement is almost like a little joke. The feature tune of that is called "At the River," but it's very sort of tossed off, and then it has a very similar structure as the first movement, but much shorter and ends extremely abruptly. And every time I've performed this work, it ends with a giggle from the audience. And so it's a very interesting work. It's a humor that is a little bit more foreign, but then somehow Ives has this magic of making sense and logic of his own style and his own language, and it's very representative of that in this violin sonata.
It is signature Ives. The fact that I can start playing an almost percussive, drum-like, motoric opening, and Kristen can come in seemingly in the same world, and then for the music to become distorted as if we're in two different worlds playing together. Yet the cacophony of it makes complete sense and creates something very fresh and new. Even the fact that it's 110 years old or so, at this point, the music really has this freshness to it.
Closing the first half of this American musical journey is Ernest Bloch's second violin sonata. Bloch was born in Geneva, Switzerland in 1880, and his music would come to embody profound spiritual and philosophical themes, many inspired by his Jewish heritage. Trained in both violin and composition, Bloch pursued studies across Europe, in Geneva, Brussels, Frankfurt, and Paris, before his first visit to the United States in 1916 at the age of 36. Soon after, he accepted a faculty position at the newly founded Mannes College of Music in New York City. Bloch's career in America flourished. He became the founding director of the Cleveland Institute of Music in 1920, and later, in 1925, the director of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. The second violin sonata, composed in 1924, the year Bloch became a U.S. citizen, was in part a response to the turbulent and challenging first sonata of 1920, which had left audiences in a state of perplexion. With the second sonata, Bloch sought to craft a work that was both ecstatic and spiritual, shaped as a single-movement, fantasy-like journey. Subtitled Poème Mystique, this sonata is luminous and introspective, embodying Bloch's deepening fascination with mysticism, inner peace, and transcendence. The composer himself described it as, quote, a personal meditation. Here is pianist Michael Stephen Brown offering his thoughts on Bloch's distinctive voice.
The sonata by Bloch, his second sonata, has a subtitle, Poème Mystique, and it's a wonderfully evocative work. A lot of Bloch's music is influenced by his spiritual and Judaic music. This is no exception. His music really does sound like Bloch. It has its own sound to it, which is really cool. Being Swiss-born American composer who had a whole rich life in this country, starting like the school at Manus and working in Cleveland and San Francisco and foraging for mushrooms in Oregon. It puts it all into his music. You can really feel this natural landscape, his reverence for the outdoors. This work was composed after a dream that was triggered by an overdose of barbiturates. Bloch was apparently depressed and wrote this work. And the piece almost functions in a dreamlike manner. It's in one continuous movement with various sections that are all motivically related to this opening theme that Kristen will play alone. Everything in the work is somewhat linked to these intervals and this gesture, very cyclical in the manner of César Franck or Ernst Chausson. The work unfolds in this manner of very sectionalized, but there is a through-line narrative, and there's a big, important event that happens in the middle section.
The sonata unfolds seamlessly, its sections flowing naturally into one another. The opening andante introduces a quiet, chant-like melody in the violin, evoking the atmosphere of sacred liturgy and setting the tone for the work's meditative spirit. Gradually, the music blossoms into a torrent of inspired melody. The animato section intensifies the mood, weaving together soaring lyricism, lush harmonies, and moments of fervent passion. One of the most striking features comes in the middle section, where Bloch juxtaposes quotations from his own Jewish cycle with fragments of the Gregorian chant Kyrie Fons Bonitatis. Here is violinist Kristen Lee highlighting this moment.
There is an amazing section in the sonata. It's almost like as if it's the golden section, because it's right in the middle of the whole sonata. And in this section, you're going to be hearing what sounds like a preacher in the middle of a congregation telling some sort of a fable or some kind of message, a very dynamic message to the congregation. And so the violin is mimicking almost something that is spoken with responses that are coming from the piano. It's a very dynamic, it's a very powerful section played in forte, fortissimo, with markings like marcato. And then it turns very suddenly into the introduction of some Gregorian chants. So to me, it feels like this is Bloch's way of almost juxtaposing the idea of the preacher, the rabbi, and then we're hearing these Gregorian chants that are maybe having some implications of some Christian ideas. And in fact, I mean, he writes the actual lyrics to the Kyrie in our score. So he's very specific that these are actual Gregorian chants.
Let us listen. The final molto quieto returns in the evocative stillness of the opening, yet the music gradually rises to a state of lyrical ecstasy, reaching ever higher in its search for transcendence.
Thank you.
Ultimately, this is an intimate poetic work, highly philosophical in nature, where Bloch's ongoing search for meaning and artistic expression is distilled into sound. After intermission, we return with John Adams's Road Movies for Violin and Piano. Born in Massachusetts in 1947, John Adams stands as one of the most influential American composers and conductors of our time. He is renowned for his distinctive musical voice, a blend of minimalist repetition, rhythmic vitality, and insightful innovation. While Adams is best known for his large-scale orchestral and operatic works, including Nixon in China and Dr. Atomic, his chamber music offers an equally fascinating glimpse into his artistic world. Here is violinist Kristen Lee sharing her thoughts on Adams's music.
I think for the general public, when they think of American classical music, a lot of that sound is much more based on the late 20th and 21st century music. And one particular style that has become most popularized is the style called minimalism. Minimalism was a big movement that started over in the West Coast in the 60s and 70s. And it was really led by composers like Steve Reich, John Adams, Terry Riley. They all came from the same area and then created this idea of the minimalist style. A lot of it is inspired by the style of like the Balinese gamelan music, where you're hearing a lot of rhythmic elements with more simplified harmonies, but then it's this constant, never stopping sort of motor that keeps going. And so it feels very like you're in a trance, and that's sort of the idea of what the minimalist music is.
Adams himself once reflected on his late embrace of chamber music, writing, and I quote, "After years of studiously avoiding the chamber music format, I have suddenly began to compose for the medium in real earnest. The 1992 Chamber Symphony was followed by the string quartet John's Book of Alleged Dances, written for Kronos in 1994. And now comes Road Movies. For years, the chamber music scenario remained a not particularly fertile bed in which to grow my musical ideas. My music of the 70s and 80s was principally about massed sonorities and the physical and emotional potency of big walls of triadic harmony. These musical gestures were not really germane to chamber music with its democratic parceling of roles, its transparency and timbral delicacy. Moreover, the challenge of writing melodically, something that chamber music demands above and beyond all else, was yet to be solved." End quote. Road Movies, composed in 1995, is a lively and inventive work that fuses the imagery of American road culture with musical exploration. As Adams put it, it's, quote, "music that is always going somewhere, just like the title implies." The piece unfolds across three movements, each with its own distinct title and each roughly 5 minutes long. The first movement, Relaxed Groove, evokes the easy, familiar rhythm of a laid-back drive. The second movement, Meditative, offers a simple reflection on several small motives, a solitary figure standing in an empty desert landscape. The final movement, 40% swing, is a perpetual motion machine. Adams explains, and I quote, "On modern MIDI sequencers, the desired amount of swing can be adjusted with almost ridiculous accuracy. 40% provides a giddy, bouncy ride somewhere between an Ives ragtime and a long ride out by the Goodman Orchestra circa 1939. It is very difficult for violin and piano to maintain over the 7-minute stretch, especially in the tricky crosshand style of the piano part. Relax and leave the driving to us." Here is pianist Michael Stephen Brown reflecting on the musical demands of this final movement.
"I find it takes enormous mental strength to survive and get through this piece. It's almost like each movement is like running on a Stairmaster for me. It's almost like sometimes you can listen to the violin and sometimes you want to avoid listening to the violin and count. It's almost written in such a cool way that it's so difficult to stay on with these loops that you kind of have to trust your instincts, and it goes so fast, especially that third movement. But it's tricky, but it's very rewarding, and you think in a certain way, oh, well, AI or a computer could do this, but it's very emotional and moving music and full of character and charm, and I love it. I think it's a phenomenal statement for violin and piano, all three movements, and have deeply contrasting moods, and he's able to say a lot with so much repetition of motives."
Following John Adams's road movies, we continue with another work for violin and piano by a living American composer, this time by none other than the pianist of tonight's concert, Michael Stephen Brown. His piece, titled Sigh, offers an intimate and expressive journey, blending his distinctive musical voice with the collaborative spirit of this duo performance. Here is Michael Stephen Brown introducing his own composition.
"The work I've written is called Sigh for violin and piano. It's in honor of my deep love for the great French composer Maurice Ravel, who happened to celebrate his 150th birthday in the year 2025. He was born in 1875. And the work is about a 4-minute impromptu, if you will, for violin and piano. It's very spontaneous, based on themes and pitches from Ravel's violin sonata that I steal right from the opening of Ravel and make my own little fantasy on Ravel's harmonic world and his whole sonic universe. And I try to incorporate a little bit of that jazzy blues style as well. So the piece has reflective and still moments in the beginning and the end, and has a much more tumultuous middle section. So it's representative of a sigh, but has a journey throughout."
We continue with another heartfelt work, this time by Amy Beach, who was a pioneering American composer and pianist, widely recognized as the first successful woman in the United States to compose and publish a large-scale symphony. Born in New Hampshire in 1867, Beach showed signs of child prodigy talent from an early age, eventually rising to prominence within Boston's vibrant musical scene as both a virtuoso pianist and, remarkably, a largely self-taught composer. Her style blended the lush romanticism of Brahms and Wagner with her own distinct lyrical voice. As part of the influential group known as the Boston Six, alongside five male composers including landmark American names like John Knowles Payne, Arthur Foote, Edward McDowell, George Chadwick, and Horatio Parker, Beach contributed not only orchestral works, but also a wealth of pieces for piano, voice, and chamber ensembles, many reflecting her love of poetry and her gift for melody. As both artist and advocate, Beach helped open doors for future generations of women in classical music, leaving behind a legacy defined by elegance, innovation, and resilience. Here is violinist Kristen Lee sharing her admiration for Amy Beach's music.
To me, I think Amy Beach is actually one of the most underrated composers right now. I'm really glad that we're seeing her name over and over again more these days. And partly the reason why I think she's a little bit underrated is because she wrote a lot of music. She wrote a lot of great chamber music. She has a beautiful violin sonata, beautiful piano quintet, and a lot of really, really beautiful works that are becoming more familiarized by the general public, which is a really great thing because her writing is very much in a style that is more familiar to what we would consider as the Germanic style, that is maybe combined with a little bit of the French harmony. And so it's beautifully romantic, a little bit more traditional, I guess, in that sense of what we think of classical music, but with definitely her own expression and her own idea of different harmonic structure.
Amy Beach's Romance, Opus 23, composed in 1893, is a beautiful example of her early lyrical style, elegant, expressive, and deeply rooted in the Romantic tradition. She wrote this piece for her close friend Maude Powell, the celebrated violinist and passionate advocate for American composers and women artists.
This piece for violin and piano, titled Romance, it's just a very delightful, beautiful representation of what Amy Beach does often with her music, where she is really a champion of writing gorgeous melodies. So this piece features gorgeous melody, but she also always has this big arc to her music. It's not just something simple and you're hearing something gorgeous, but you definitely go into something a little bit more dramatic. There's a very climactic moment. There's a return of the first beautiful tune and then ends where you hear the beautiful angels flying away. So it's a really beautiful work and we're very excited to perform it for you.
From the opening bars, the relationship between the violin and piano feels incredibly special. The violin's melody is warmly embraced by the piano's gentle, supportive textures. The way these two instruments merge into a single unified voice is exquisitely beautiful.
The end of the romance sort of goes into this coda where we hear material that we kind of haven't heard before, and Amy Beach brings us to this very angelic moment where it dissipates sort of into the clouds and ends in this very high upper stratosphere of the violin. And it's a really, really gorgeous way, an intimate way of ending the work. The closing piece on this Carte Blanche concert is George Gershwin's fantasy on themes from Porgy and Bess in an arrangement for violin and piano.
Composed in 1935, Porgy and Bess is a groundbreaking American opera that masterfully blends classical music with jazz, blues, spirituals, and folk traditions. Based on Hayward's 1925 novel, Porgy, the opera tells a poignant story of a disabled beggar, Porgy, and his struggle to rescue Bess from the grip of drugs, violence, and toxic relationships in the imaginary African-American community of Catfish Row in Charleston, South Carolina. From its inception, Gershwin envisioned Porgy and Bess as a serious operatic work that honored the depth and richness of Black culture and music, boldly departing from the conventions of both Broadway and European opera. Since its premiere, Porgy and Bess has become a cornerstone of the American musical and operatic repertoire. Iconic songs like Summertime and It Ain't Necessarily So showcase Gershwin's genius for unforgettable melody and vivid musical storytelling. Due to the enormous popularity of Porgy and Bess, many of the world's foremost violinists, including the legendary Jascha Heifetz, have created their own arrangements of its iconic melodies. Yet among these, one adaptation has steadily risen in reputation, standing out for its depth and artistic substance beyond mere rephrasing of familiar material. This is the Russian violinist and composer Igor Frolov's 1991 arrangement. Frolov's arrangement is a magnetic, virtuosic reimagining of Gershwin's most beloved themes. In the grand tradition of the 19th century violin fantasies by composers like Wieniawski and Sarasate, Frolov masterfully weaves together melodies such as Summertime, My Man's Gone Now, and It Ain't Necessarily So, transforming them into expressive, technically brilliant vehicles for both performers. With lush harmonizations, improvisatory cadences, and imaginative turns, the piece emerges not as a mere medley, but as a fully realized, compelling concert work in its own right. Here is violinist Kristen Lee sharing her excitement about closing the program with this work.
So we'll be ending our program with perhaps the most celebrated American composer, George Gershwin's music that is very familiar to so many people. This is a piece called Fantasy on themes from Porgy and Bess. So many of these tunes are so beloved by everybody. But what is interesting about this particular work is that we're going to be bringing an arrangement by a name that is lesser known, named Frolov. He was a beautiful Russian violinist. And he wrote this beautiful medley of the Porgy and Bess melodies that features the violin and the piano and adds a lot of very dynamic, exciting moments that really celebrates these tunes. I personally love it so much because it gives so much to the piano as much as the violin. Very, very exciting. The perfect way to end the program. And I'm just so delighted to be able to play this with Michael.
It's a absolutely slam dunk, super fun virtuoso for both instruments. I have had so much fun learning this piece, and it's refreshing and different from the Heifetz version, of course. And I do, must say, as a pianist, get a couple of fun cadenzas to play that use the whole piano, use all these themes from Gershwin.
I'm just really thrilled to be able to share this program with Michael. We were so lucky to be able to give this program to some other audiences, and we've been just getting wonderful feedback, and it's just been such a joy to be able to share a lot of music that may be a little bit more unfamiliar to a lot of people, but making them realize that there's so much great music out there that's still to be discovered. So I hope that this can be that experience for our Menlo audience as well.
Thank you so much, Kristen and Michael. We are also looking so much forward to this thrilling performance this summer. This concludes our discussion of the wonderful Carte Blanche with Kristen Lee and Michael Stephen Brown. A special thank you to Amy Koda for her immense help in procuring the audio samples, to all the organizations who provided access to their catalogs, and to the artists who agreed to share their thoughts on the music. I'm Dmitry Atapin, and I cannot wait to see you at our concerts. Audio notes are written and produced by Dmitry Atapin and Heian Park in consultation with David Finkel and Wuhan. Many thanks to Kristen Lee and Michael Stephen Brown for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Kreisler Preludium and Allegro, performed by Benjamin Weilman Violin and Yikuan Sunwu Piano, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Adams, Road Movies for Violin and Piano, performed by Chad Hoops Violin and Gloria Chien Piano, courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. The rest of the excerpts, that is the Ives Sonata for Violin and Piano, the Bloch Sonata for Violin and Piano, the Beach Romance, and the Frolov Gershwin Fantasy, are all performed by Kristen Lee Violin and Michael Stephen Brown Piano, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.